Does anybody here know everybody's? No? Kind of? Kind of? There's some regulars, and there's some new people, and there's some out-of-town people. Who's some of the newer kind of people? Okay. Okay. So I'll primarily be addressing you all who just raised your hand, and everyone else will get something too, I think. I've just completed a very enlivening and exhausting at the same time 13-part seminar on a literature called Sri Brahma Samhita, and it's only half because it's so voluminous, although the book is as skinny as you can get. It's 62 verses, and it's a description by the process of creation. It's describing the spiritual world. It's describing the process of self-realization. It's the state of consciousness in one, the stage of self-realization, and one of the ending points, the last five verses, is discussing how to go from mixed consciousness to pure consciousness. For those of you that are from India, from Sakam Bhakti to Nishkam Bhakti, from a position of spiritual, mixed spiritual and material desire to unmixed, pure consciousness, pure spiritual consciousness. How to? How to continue one's involvement, as is the case of Lord Brahma, with constructing a universe. Each of us is doing something. There's a big university here and lots of people learning how to do something. Maybe build a software program, or build a machine, or build a building or something. Do something wonderful and earn a living. Nothing compared to the complexity of what Brahma had to do, build the universe. And how to involve oneself in things of this world. It's a twofold question. If I go on the path of a spiritual trajectory, will I not be neglecting my duties and responsibilities of this world? And then converse, if I'm carrying out my duties and responsibilities of this world, is that not going to interfere with my spiritual trajectory? Aren't the two in diametric conflict with one another? So I'll just give a quick summary of the instruction that comes at the end. It's literally Krishna instructing Brahma. Because Brahma, he became enlightened, well acquainted with the ocean of truth in the language of Sri Brahma Samhita. He became a perfected being. He understood not only his position as an eternal soul, part of the Supreme, and in that position as soul, part of the Supreme, eternally, not just this particular embodiment, but spiritually, eternally, the servant of the Supreme Soul. And then his realization went further to realize his rasa, or the mellow of love, in that spiritual identity as a maidservant of Krishna. And then he offered beautiful prayers. Govindam Adipurusham Tamaham Bhajami. A series of like 35 verses, just beautiful, beautiful verses glorifying Govinda. So Govinda then speaks to him and says, my beloved, he addresses Brahma that way, I see that with all of this exalted consciousness that you also have some affinity for matter. You still have a desire to create a universe. And you have a concern that this may be in conflict with your spiritual enlivenment. So I'm now going to explain to you how that need not be the case. And so, in summary, his explanation is, well, first he gives it, he describes pure consciousness, and then he says that one can attain that pure consciousness progressively by slow, gradual steps, coming to the stage of perfection. By always, he gives four things. Always striving for self-realization. So while you're doing your things, inwardly, always striving for self-realization and following sadachar, codes of theistic conduct, abhyasa, constantly practice, performing duties in a way that's harmonious with and sympathetic with and conducive to spiritual realization. And being guided by proper knowledge. So, sambandha gyan, knowing what's what, knowing how things that exist have their relationship with the Supreme and connect those things with the Supreme through loving service. And then he describes that there are natural things. Anyone who is embodied has a certain affinity, a natural required needs of the body, needs of the mind, and interpersonal social needs. When those are, and the fulfillment of those duties and needs, when they're joined with the activities of sadhana, or regulatively, it's like you have your beads and your bead bag. So regularly chanting the holy name, hearing spiritual sound vibrations, transcendental teachings, and activities that directly connect one's consciousness with the Supreme. When that awakened state of relationship with the Supreme is used to dedicate those activities to the Supreme, then they serve to be as spiritualizing for one's existence as the direct activities are. A term is introduced in Brahma Samhita that I'm not normally familiar with, but it's called Gauna, G-A-U-N-A, Bhakti. Gauna Bhakti, and the translation of that is subsidiary. That's Bhakti Siddhanta's word. Subsidiary. It's like there's a big company, it has its subsidiaries. That's what I'm used to hearing, subsidiary. But subsidiary in this case means there's primary and like secondary. It's related to, but it's not the primary thing. The primary thing in devotion is Shravanam Kirtanam Vishnu Smaranam, hearing and chanting and remembering, and bandaram, praying, and archanam, deity worship, and these nine processes of bhakti that are described in Srimad Bhagavatam, itemized and then described. So doing directly devotional things, that's primary, and the others are, they can follow behind. It's like a pin. And then there's the shaft of the pin, and there's the head of the pin. You push on the head of the pin, but it's the point of the pin that goes into the cloth, followed by the shaft of the pin, by the force on the head of the pin. So, the point of the pin, that's the primary activities of bhakti. But when that moves, then these subsidiary or secondary or assisting activities, because we have our human requirements, and they get complex sometimes. So, but those human requirements, when following behind the primary activity, it spiritualizes our senses and our mind and our social interactions. Our lives become spiritualized as a result. So that's what we heard for a bunch of hours while in Seattle. And then I want to share that message in relation to a little section of the Srimad Bhagavatam that I've been speaking from. So I'm going to speak from this evening. Canto 3, chapter 22, text number 36. And the subject is Swayambhuva Manu. So for those of you that don't know who Swayambhuva Manu is, I'll do a little background. Time. The Vedic picture of time is everything moves in cycles. Like the seasons move in cycles. The ages of mankind move in cycles. And anything that you want to think of. I mean, the hand and the clock moves in cycles. Creation, maintenance, annihilation, resting for some time. And then again, creation, maintenance, and annihilation, and resting for some time. So that the circles may be small or big. Living entities are born. They grow. They produce some byproducts. They dwindle, and eventually they die. And then the soul moves on, and then another soul enters another body that's born, grows for some time, matures, produces byproducts, dwindles, and dies. It's just, time moves things, and time moves in cycles. So, one of those cycles is the life of Brahma. The life of Brahma is the measurement of the duration of the universe. Because he's born at the beginning of the universe, and when his lifetime is over, the universe is over, and then the universe is withdrawn. But within his lifetime, there's days. That's another cycle. So, bear with me, I'll get to Swayambhuva Manu in a minute. Those days last for 4,320,000 years. And there's cycles within those. There's Satyuga, Tretyuga, Dwapara Yuga, and Kali Yuga. And without going into all those numbers, one complete yuga cycle is 4,320,000 years. And there's 1,000 of those yuga cycles in the course of one day, and his night is of equal duration. And during that 1,000 yuga cycles that makes up his one day, there's 14 manus. And manus, they're the emperor of the universe. It's a really big post. And they maintain order, spiritual order. They give laws of mankind, described in Manu Samhita. They give laws by which human society is to live in such a way that it's conducive for spiritual elevation, and it's not in violation of natural laws. And you break the laws of Manu and you got a problem, because you're violating laws of nature, and when you violate laws of nature, there's a reaction. Action, reaction. So you do in harmony with the laws of nature kind of actions, and you get something beneficial, and you violate those laws and you get a problem. So Manu gives laws. And he's overseeing the well-being of those who are law-abiding. And he's also overseeing the correction of those who are law-breaking. That's what kings do. So, but his kingdom is the universe. He's got a big responsibility, a big post. And the first Manu is directly born from Lord Brahma. Literally, directly from the body of Lord Brahma. He and his wife, Shatarupa, they're just, because Brahma is creating the universe, he needs somebody to look after it. He's so powerful just by his contemplation, by his thought. Boom. Manu is created. And in an adult form. There's not like a little baby and he has to go through all that stuff. He's mature and his wife is also present. And his service is to give laws of mankind and to produce praja, offspring, and to maintain order within the universe. Swayambhuva Manu and Shatrurupa, his queen, have two sons and three daughters, and the description has the section that I've been reading from is the marriage of one of his daughters, Devahuti, marrying Kardama Muni, and eventually coming up very soon is from them an incarnation of the Supreme Lord appears as their son. Before Kardama Muni and Devahuti were married, Kardama Muni was requested by his father, Lord Brahma, go to the forest and qualify yourself to produce good children, good praja, because I've made this universe, I need to fill it up with good population. Please assist me. So he agrees to assist his father, and before producing good offspring, one has to purify and qualify oneself, purify consciousness. So he does that according to the means for that particular age. And the means for spiritual practice in Satya Yuga is meditation. So he goes to the forest in a very quiet, serene, secluded place on the bank of the river Saraswati. He builds a little cottage, and his activity all day long for long, long numbers of years is in a trance of meditation, fixing his mind upon the Lord of the Heart. And the Lord of the Heart becomes so pleased that he appears before him. Lord Vishnu, from his abode at the milk ocean, that Shiradakshayi Vishnu is the same as the Lord within the heart of every living being, he descends on the back of Garuda. Garuda's arms are flapping. The Lord is standing, smiling very happily at Kardama Muni, who is overwhelmed with ecstasy seeing the personality of Godhead in this way. He falls flat before him on the ground and offers beautiful prayers. And then Lord Vishnu speaks and he says to Kardama Muni a series of things. He says, you pleased me very much by your very, very sincere devotion, and therefore have come before you. Then he says, I know your heart's desire, and it shall be fulfilled. Specifically, his heart's desire is following the order of Lord Brahma to help produce good offspring. But he's a great devotee of the Lord, so he, Kardama Muni, wants the Supreme Lord to appear as his son. That's pretty far out. But that's his desire. It's called Vatsalya Rasa, parental affection. Love of God in parental affection. So Lord Vishnu says, I shall appear as your son. And your wife shall be Devahuti. In fact, 2 days from now, Swayambhuva Manu is going to come here and see you in the forest. And he's going to be bringing his wife, his queen, Shatarupa, and Devahuti, and he's going to request you to marry her, and you should say yes. Made it really easy. Sometimes it gets really complicated. Just say yes, because she's very qualified in this way. And her qualifications match your qualifications. And in the course of living in household life, you'll produce 9 daughters, and then I will appear as your son. Although you're involved in, it's related to the topic that I began with, but although you will be involved in family life, because this activity will be dedicated exclusively to me, and your consciousness will be fixed upon me, this will not lower your consciousness, but will help fulfill your higher purpose, and you will achieve spiritual perfection. And at the end of your life, you will come to me in the spiritual world. Your whole life is laid out by a short little visit by Lord Vishnu. And then Garuda flies away and Lord Vishnu disappears. So Karva Muni is feeling so fortunate, so blessed that Lord Vishnu has come. And sure enough, 2 days later, Swayambhuva Manu comes, finds him in the forest. There's this very beautiful exchange where those of you that are knowledgeable a little bit about Vedic culture, normally it is the Kshatriya who offers first his respect to the Brahmana. But in this case, because the Brahmana or Kardava Muni is receiving the guest, he speaks first to the guest and honors his guest. That's also culture. And he appreciates in many, many ways the duties of the king, the responsibilities of the king, the importance of the king, the importance, the qualification that Swayambhuva Manu has to match those requirements. And basically he says, you've come here for some reason, whatever it is, the answer is yes. That's a good way to start a conversation. And then Swayambhuva Manu speaks to the Brahmana, Kardama, saying that the position of a Brahmana within society is so important, the qualities of a Brahmana are like this, the duties of the Brahmana are like this, and you embody all of these things, and so I, as the emperor, am so fortunate to have such a qualified person in my kingdom. It's like respect and respect. Our commentators write, when that is given the name Brahma Karya, and when persons who are doing administration and persons that are seers of the truth, wise, learned brahmanas, respect one another, then you have a good situation. And when there's not qualification or there's disrespect, then you've got some turmoil upstairs in the higher orders of society. Then Swayambhuva Manu says, yes, I have come here for a particular purpose, and he points to his daughter. I happen to know from Narada Muni, because Narada Muni had visited Kardava Muni and informed Swayambhuva Manu, he'd like to have a good wife. So So I've been informed by Narada that you desire to have a qualified wife. And Narada also indicated that he feels my daughter is a suitable and qualified wife for you. Here's her qualifications. Please accept her as your wife. And Kardamuni says, very clearly, she's very qualified. He lists her qualifications. And being directly the daughter of Swayambhuva Manu, your good self, it is a suitable arrangement. He says many other things, but I'm summarizing. And I have one concern, or like a condition, and that is, when there is a son that is of age to look after your daughter, once he's matured, then I would like to return back to the forest and resume my activities of achieving spiritual perfection, practicing the Yuga Dharma, the means of spiritual attainment for the age. And his father says, this is Vedic culture, this is fine. So that condition is met. Some description of their marriage is provided, and then Swayambhuva Manu returns back to his palace where he rules the world. It describes his palace, it describes the place, it describes his conduct. And his conduct is exactly mirroring or demonstrating in detail what I said at the very beginning about Krishna's instructions to Brahma about how one can cultivate spiritual realization while at the same time involving oneself in affairs of this world. I'll read some of the verses because they're very instructive. Very nice. After asking and obtaining the great sage's permission to leave after the marriage, the monarch mounted his chariot with his wife and started for his capital, followed by his retinue. Along the way, he saw the prosperity of the tranquil rishi's beautiful hermitages on both sides of the charming banks of the Saraswati, the river so agreeable to saintly persons. Remember, it's Satya Yuga. There's no commerce along the banks of the river and pollution and other kinds of things. Just very tranquil and peaceful and beautiful. Overjoyed to know of his arrival, his subject came forth from Brahmavarta to greet their returning Lord with songs, prayers, and musical instruments. The city of Barhishmati, rich in all kinds of wealth, was so called because Lord Vishnu's hair dropped there from his body when he manifested himself as Lord Bor, Varaha. The Varaha appears in the very beginning part of creation. It's described earlier, and it's going to be later in the Bhagavatam also described. When Varaha rescued the earth that had fallen out of its orbit into the lower regions of the universe in the Garbhadaka ocean, he went within that water and lifted the earth planet and placed it back in its orbit. And after the earth was placed back in its orbit, he shook his body to get the water off. And some hair from his body fell at Barhishmati and produced grasses that were then used by sages for sitting on and for performing their devotional activity. Manu spread a seed of kushas and kashas and worshiped the Lord, the personality of Godhead, by whose grace he had obtained the rule of the terrestrial globe. Having entered the city of Brihaspati in which he had previously lived, Manu entered his palace, which was filled with an atmosphere that eradicated the three miseries of material existence. Emperor Swayambhuva Manu enjoyed life with his wife and subjects and fulfilled his desires without being disturbed by unwanted principles contrary to the process of religion. Celestial musicians and their wives sang in chorus about the pure reputation of the emperor, and early in the morning every day he used to listen to the pastimes of the Supreme Personality of Godhead with a loving heart. Thus Swayambhuva Manu was a saintly king. Although absorbed in material happiness, he was not dragged to the lowest grade of life, for he was always enjoying his material happiness in a Krishna conscious atmosphere. Of course, there's commentary that goes along with this, and I could easily make comments because specifically to the point that it's Srimad Bhagavatam is Bhagavat Purana, and Purana means history. So the Puranas are exhibiting teachings in the context of story or history. So the teaching I just presented, first thing, how to be involved in worldly things at the same time cultivate spiritual consciousness. And so it's a teaching. Now here's an example of that teaching. Here's what it looks like, at least one example of what it looks like, through the example of a very exalted personality, Manu, ruler of the universe. And his spiritual qualification is being indicated. He didn't get distracted by this unlimited opulence and people glorifying him and musicians and praise and honor, because he was worthy of praise. One of the things that's a difficulty when one begins to make a little spiritual progress is that one becomes proud of that little spiritual progress. And the honor that one receives and enjoying the honor that one receives, or some special recognition and enjoying that because, oh, you become a nice spiritually elevated person. Oh yes, I'm doing very well. He didn't have that problem because his attention was simply the personality of Godhead. And he did those things that enriched that attraction for the personality of Godhead, strengthened it, and nurtured it. And he did his duties, and there was opulence surrounding him, but he wasn't distracted by that. He didn't become degraded by pride, power, riches, and opulence, and fame, and reputation, and honor, and praise. Those things are very intoxicating for an impure person. But he was protected from that by his strong focus on spiritual practice. And the verse that we discussed this morning is, even right up to the end of his life, normally when age goes on, the mind becomes a little feeble. One can't, discriminate things properly, commonly a little senile, and aches and pains of the body from the things that don't work and the feeling of frustration because I can't do what I used to do and all those things that go with old age. He was not inflicted by those things because the presence of spiritual consciousness that had been cultivated through his life. And his life is a long life. It's 71 yuga cycles. And one yuga cycle is 4,320,000 years. He had a pretty long life. 71 times that. And that's the verse that we're discussing. I'll read the verse in the purport. It's also discussing the Brahma-Bhuta stage of realization, and I'll explain that in a moment. Swayambhuva Manu passed his time, which lasted 71 cycles of four yugas, or ages, always thinking of Vasudev, Krishna, and always engaged in matters regarding Vasudev. Thus he transcended the three destinations. There's a verse in Bhagavad Gita where Krishna says to Arjuna, very simply, engage in your prescribed duties and always think of me. So same as this instruction Krishna gave to Arjuna, gave to Brahma, that I mentioned at the beginning. You want to create a universe, or whatever is your thing is, the world calling that you have, the ability that God has given you, and you use it in serving Him in some way. Do that according to the codes of theistic conduct. Don't violate the codes of theistic conduct. Sadachar, act properly. At the same time, inwardly cultivate thoughts of the Supreme. And the hearing and discussing topics of the Supreme awaken and strengthen thoughts of the Supreme. I'll just share this little side item. Before coming here to Portland and the Seattle Northwest U.S., I was in Vrindavan, India, which is a very wonderful place to be. There was a group of devotees, and we were going to visit the different places of Krishna's pastimes in Vrindavan together. And it was delightful. It was a great opportunity to focus one's mind simply upon Krishna, in the land of Krishna, Vrindavan, where Krishna performed his pastimes. How to say, very purifying, very enlivening. And every place we went, we had like this nice kirtan. Govinda, who came and visited here in Portland area, was with us every day for whatever it was, 11 days, hearing kirtan and kirtan. So we ended up in Jaipur, where Govindaji deity is, and the original Radha Gopinath deity, and the Radha Damodar deity that used to be in Vrindavan, they were taken to Jaipur for safety, because there was invasions of wicked Aurangzeb that wanted to destroy temples and destroy deities, so they're taken there for protection. So we visited there, and that was the end of our pilgrimage. And then I had this long journey coming back to America. It started with an evening flight from Jaipur to Delhi. Then I had a robust 2 hours of sleep to then get on an international flight heading for Frankfurt, Germany, and onwards. So I told the devotees, I'm really tired. I don't know if I'll hear my alarm clock. So, you know, after I've rested for 2 hours, please wake me up. But I set the alarm clock. And I didn't hear it. But I was hearing a kirtan. And the devotee came finally after 20 minutes of the alarm going off, said, you know, you have to get ready to go to the airport again. I said, oh, I was just in kirtan. Because you just do kirtan and kirtan and think of Krishna and think of Krishna. You, even in your sleep, you're thinking of Krishna. What to speak of the rest of the time? even when you're doing your worldly duties, you're thinking of Krishna because he's dearmost. He's the dearmost thing to our heart. In fact, he's within our heart, literally and figuratively. He's within our heart. He's the nearest thing and dearest thing to us. Just that we're distracted. Boy, are we distracted. But when that remembrance is awakened by acts of devotion, the primary, and following behind the primary, the shaft of the pin follows that. The subsidiary activities become enriched with spiritual consciousness. So even when you're sleeping, you can be with Krishna in kirtan or going to his, you know, hearing, just like this, hearing of his exchanges with Kardava Muni. Later he's going to become his son. So here's Swayambhuva Manu and the father of Devahuti, who is the mother of Kapila Dev. So he's super qualified too. And he was always thinking of Krishna and always engaged in activities for Krishna, for Vasudev. And then it says, the last part of the verse is, thus he transcended the three destinations. And the purport explains, the three destinations correspond with the three modes of nature. So I understand even in your introductory Bhakti Vriksha classes, you've discussed a little bit about the modes of nature. So in the purport, Prabhupada explains just what Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita about the modes of nature. Urdvam gacchati sanfasta madhye tishtanti rajasa adho gacchanti tamasa. One who is situated in the mode of goodness goes to the heavenly regions, the higher planetary systems. Those who are situated in passion stay in this middle planetary region, and those situated in the mode of ignorance go to the bad place, the darker regions of the universe, the hellish planets, according to the modes of nature that we associate with and we cultivate. The destination of the soul matches those modes of nature that we develop some affinity for. And this earthly, a little bit about Vedic cosmology, really simple. This earthly planet is in the middle planetary region, and characterized in the middle planetary region, if you haven't noticed, is passion, where intense endeavor to achieve something, like, you know, develop the economy, whether it's the nation or a family or an individual, strive, win, achieve, succeed, acquire, develop, passion. And the lower planetary regions, the hellish planets, consciousness is very covered. The consciousness, specifically spiritual consciousness, becomes very covered. One's ability to discern subtle things, like, you know, the soul within the body that's animating the body, and other types of spiritual and subtle teachings, they're not accessible. And in the higher planetary regions, even above what in various scriptures is called heaven by different terminologies, the Vedic cosmology teaches above that the Svarga realm, there's four other regions above heaven within this created region, within the created universe. Maharloka, Janloka, Tapaloka, and Brahmaloka. And there's characteristic activities on each of those planets. they're described in the Vedas. But what's said about Swayambhuva Manu is his consciousness was such that at the time of death, he passed over those three regions, the lower, middle, and even the topmost planet of this material realm. He attained the kingdom of God, because the kingdom of God is characterized by no influence of passion, ignorance, or goodness. Rather, Vishuddha Sattva. I don't know if you discussed this when you talked about the modes of nature, but something that Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita in chapter 14, the modes of nature, he says, wherever there is one of the modes, the other two are also present, and they're competing for supremacy. So where the mode of goodness is present, there's also some passion, some ignorance, and they're competing for supremacy. And sometimes then the mode of passion is prominent, there's some goodness and some ignorance. And the mode of ignorance may be prominent, there's some goodness, some passion, and always competing for supremacy. That's how the modes of nature are active. But there's a realm that where there's no passion and no ignorance. And that's Vishuddha Sattva, the realm of the personality of Godhead, Vaikuntha, the kingdom of God. So the point that's being made here is because of the kind of cultivation that Swayambhuva Manu had during his life, at the end of this body, at the end of his life, he attained that state of matching his consciousness, where he attained the kingdom of God. Back to our discussion in Brahma Samhita, this long seminar I just completed, it's one of the first things that was discussed. Krishna's position and Krishna's abode. And his abode, everything there, all the personalities, the trees and the river and the cows and everything, is of the nature of Vishuddha Sattva, pure goodness. And in that state of pure goodness, the happiness is similarly completely pure and unlimited. There's no tinge of selfishness and all of the other kinds of contaminations that go with material existence. It's conspicuous by its absence. Prabhupada uses that phrase. And because he was living a life like that, that's the state he attained. Again, there's a verse in Bhagavad Gita that speaks the same. Yam yam vapi smaran bhavam chajatante kalevaram. Smaran means remembering. Whatever it is that you remember, whatever the mind is fixed upon, chajatante, at the time of death, that state you will attain without fail. If your mind is in goodness, mind is in passion, mind is in ignorance, the mind is in transcendence. You'll attain that state corresponding with how the mind is fixed. I'll just share something anecdotal. One time, a number of years ago, my service was distributing books, Prabhupada's books, Bhagavad Gita's and all of Prabhupada's books. And one of the places that I was distributing books was at JFK. And it was interesting because we didn't have a permit to distribute books at JFK, so I kind of, learned where the flights were, where it was busy, and went and just distributed books that way. So at the end of the day, I took the train from JFK, the Q10 bus, to the F train to go to the temple. And it was about like 8 o'clock at night going back to the temple. And I had to cross from the F train to the A train, to the A train, to the F train to get to the temple. So just picture, you're in New York City, and you're getting out of one train, getting onto the platform to go to the other train that hadn't arrived yet. And when I get out of the train on the platform at 8 o'clock at night, there's a big crowd of people around something. Right? So I moved in to see what it was, and there was somebody dying on the subway platform. And everyone was crowded around, you know, like asking the man for what was his last, his parting wish. Because they called an ambulance, but it looked like, you know, he was, the countdown, he was on his way out. So, what would you like? Anything we can get for you? The guy said, could I have a cigarette? Get the guy a cigarette. They lit the cigarette. He couldn't even hold it. Someone had to put it to his lips. Because his body was nearly finished. So he took a few puffs on the cigarette. And they said, is there anything else that you want? Anything else we you want? We can get you? And he said, I want Susie. And his head tilted back, and he went out. He was died thinking of his cigarette and Susie. So according to the teaching of Bhagavad Gita, whatever your mind is fixed on at the time of death, that state you will attain without a fail. So a certain mixture of passion and ignorance in that man's life. Perhaps he became a woman in his next life. Because that's one of the indications. If you're like Bharat Maharaj, those of you that are from India, you know the story of Bharat Maharaj, a great king that went to the forest at the end, final stages of his life to perfect his life. He saw a baby deer left without the mother. There's a whole sequence of events that preceded that. He saw the baby deer unprotected. So he went to the other side of the river, rescued the baby deer, brought the baby deer to his hermitage, and became absorbed in the deer. Somewhat absorbed in the deer that his spiritual practices became diminished and eventually neglected. He was just all the time involved in being the mother and the father and the caretaker of the deer. Until one day the deer wandered away, and he was so attached to the deer he couldn't sleep. And there's this monologue that he's talking to himself about, oh, I've offended the deer, and so the deer has gone away, but certainly the deer will be kind to come back, and I didn't mean anything so bad, and like that he just couldn't sleep. So he then went, got up in the middle of the night looking for the deer, and he fell off a cliff. Thinking of the deer, and when he hit the jagged rocks, his body was finished, and because he was thinking of the of a deer in his next life, he became a deer, although he was a great king. But whatever the mind is fixed upon, that state you will attain without fail, Krishna says. So because Swayambhuvamanda was fixed in Vasudev, he attained the abode of Vasudev, which is beyond the three destinations, beyond the three modes of nature. And in the purport, Prabhupada is speaking about the Brahma-Bhuta stage. Now, little Bhagavad Gita lesson. There's two verses in Bhagavad Gita where Krishna speaks about Brahma-Bhuta. One of them is Brahma-Bhuta prasanatma nasochati nakangsati Samuk Sarveshu Bhuteshu Vad Bhaktim Labhate Param. Nice verse. Where one who has attained, Brahma-Bhuta means the spiritual platform. Brahman. Platform. Spiritual platform of consciousness. For such a person, there's neither hankering nor lamenting. No. Duality doesn't touch you. I want. I don't want. I gained something, I lost something. It doesn't touch you. Brahma-Bhuta stage. Samak sarveshu bhuteshu. One sees all living entities equally. And such a person then can enter into the realm of devotional service. Mad bhaktim labhate param. But there's another verse, because you studied, little bird told me you heard about the modes of nature. So I'm speaking about that. At the end of that modes of nature chapter, chapter 14, there's a very important verse where Krishna is answering Arjuna's question, how do you go beyond the modes of nature? Krishna answers, mam chayo vyabhicharena bhakti yogena sevate sagunan samatityaitan brahma bhuyaya kalpate. By taking shelter of transcendence, by taking shelter of Krishna, who is beyond the modes of nature, one can go beyond the modes of nature and attain the stage of Brahman, the spiritual platform. Just one last thing. Again, this is a nice reference from the seminar. I think this is going to stay with me for quite some while, because I spent so much time just concentrating on this wonderful message, and it's like it went in deep. It's got to come out. There's a commentary. Our spiritual master, the founder of the Hare Krishna movement, Srila Prabhupada, his spiritual master was Bhakti Siddhanta, who wrote this commentary on Brahma Samhita that I was presenting. And his father was also a member of the disciplic succession named Bhakti Vinod Thakur. And he, in his commentary on that verse, it's 14:26 Bhagavad Gita. Can you sit still? Is it possible? Just like, thanks. He's having a kirtan in the front here. So, Bhaktivinoda Thakur says the spiritual platform, this Brahma Bhuta stage, has nearly perfect and perfect. The nearly perfect, he says, is where one understands the Supreme and one's position as his servant, but there's still some contact with matter and material absorption, material attraction. Something like what we discussed about Lord Brahma. He had this incredible realization of Govinda and his position in relation to him, but he also was attracted to constructing a universe. Then there's Bhaktivinoda Thakur explains, by continuing with the processes of the primary activities, hearing and chanting and remembering and praying and worshipping and serving the lotus feet and so forth, then another stage comes where there's absolutely no affinity for matter. Such a person resides in the spiritual world, even they may be moving about in this world, because their consciousness is fully absorbed in the Supreme. And he then says that's rare. So more appropriate is for us, he instructs, to practice in this former way, make our best effort to understand what is our position in relation to Krishna, and in that consciousness carry out our duties of life. And if we do like that and continue to cultivate through hearing and chanting and remembering and praying and worshipping and so forth, the sadhana bhakti activities, that stage of perfection and ultimately ending up where Swayambhuva Mother was, in the spiritual world. That will be the fruit, the result. So we're not Swayambhuva Mother. We're way down here somewhere. Aren't they? Like, we're not way up there. We're down here. But nor are we like Lord Brahma, so qualified. But these exalted personalities demonstrate by their character, by their quality, by their example, how we can gradually attain spiritual elevation, even while involved in our worldly things, gradually attain spiritual elevation to such a way that our needs are met, the happinesses that keep one going and in the world can be met, but ultimately importantly, is that our spiritual well-being can be fulfilled. And so it's not a requirement that we renounce the world. Let's just end with this. Something that happens at our temples regularly is there are classes. Like the last time I was, just before coming here, at the last Sunday, I spoke at our Naperville Center, which is in the suburbs of Chicago. And there was a world religion class that came to the Sunday program in Naperville. It happens all the time. People that are studying, they want to come and see like a real life specimen. Like, you know, the monarch butterfly, here's our spots and here's our antenna and we flap our wings like this. So they want to see a real live, you know, practitioner of the from their textbooks, Hinduism. And from our perspective, it's devotees of Krishna. So in any case, it happens all the time. And sometimes there's like a whole class, 30, 40, 50, 60, and even more. Sometimes two or three classes come. And they want to have like a basic ABC of like who we are, what we do, and what our beliefs are, and what our rituals. They're really into what our rituals are. So, you know, at the end, there's some common questions that they ask, like, why do you shave your head? What's the stuff on your forehead? And can you get married? Then another one is, because they're thinking of like a classic monastic life. So one of their questions is, To be a member of this religion, do you have to renounce all your worldly possessions? Because that's like a monastic idea. You, to enter into a monastery, you take a vow. Some orders have this. You renounce all worldly possessions. So, the reply that I give is no. It's not that you have to renounce all worldly possessions, but you do have to renounce the misconception that you have worldly possessions to renounce. And they go, what? And so the understanding is, like Swayambhuva Manu, whatever it is that you have, where did it come from? And when you're gone, where's it going to go to? It's not yours. It's someone else's. Temporarily, it's in your hand, and then it's going to be gone from your hand. And your hand is going to be gone too, and you're going to be gone too. So, it's not yours. So the misconception that to be renounced is stuff belongs to you, but it does belong to someone, and that someone is the person unto whom that something should be given to. Prabhupada gives this example. Supposing you're walking along the street and on the sidewalk you see a $100 bill. Or he said, say, you see a wallet. And maybe it's got some money in it. Now, you could do a number of different things. You could just keep walking because it's not yours. Or you could look this way, look that way, and it goes into your pocket. Now it's mine. Or you could find out whose wallet it is and return it to that person. Now, of the three, Prabhupada's explanation is, obviously the third is the best. Return to the person the property that belongs to the person. So similarly, bhakti, or devotion to the Supreme, means one of the aspects of it is recognizing who is the proprietor of things and return those things to the proprietor. And in fact, all things come from one source. That's the monotheism perspective of bhakti. There's one Supreme, he's the source of everything, and therefore everything belongs to him, and therefore everything should be used in service to him. And when one uses things in service to him, the false sense of proprietorship and the whole false ego program dissolves. And instead we're acting with our true sense of self and the true sense of our position within this world. And then we can act with full enthusiasm without worrying about renouncing worldly possessions, because everything belongs to Krishna. And whatever it is that's in my hand, and whatever it is that's in his hand, and whatever is in his hand, it's all the property of Krishna. And so we interact with one another socially in such a way we're respecting he has some facility to do something nice for Krishna. And he and she and they have something they can do nice for Krishna. And that's very nice because Krishna will be pleased. And that's the goal, that Krishna will be pleased. So then we can have social harmony and not a whole big false ego thing going on of clashing of false egos. No, it's mine, no, it's mine, no, it's mine. And it's so silly. Like the thing with Japan and China and US and that piece of ocean. Who does it belong to? You got to notify me. You can't fly a plane over there. You're in trouble. Just send some fighter planes and shoot you down. It's mine. Anyway, and that's just one little sample of what goes on since time immemorial. Due to an improper conception of what's what and who are we. So it's a peaceful life and a happy life, but We need to purify ourselves to get to that position. And what we're doing right now, hearing these nice messages from Srimad Bhagavatam, is very helpful. And continue like that. Cultivate, inwardly cultivate spiritual awareness, God consciousness, while performing one's duties in a responsible, theistic way. Hare Krishna. Any questions or discussion? You have one?
Question.
I saw it bubbling up.
Yeah, well, I have a lot of questions, but I gotta think of a good one to ask. So, the nine devotional services, what are those?
Okay. You want Sanskrit at first and then English. Shravanam, hearing. Kirtanam, speaking or vibrating. Smaranam, remembering. Hearing, chanting, and they follow in sequence. Hearing, chanting, remembering. And then there's another three. Archanam, deity worship. Bandhanam, prayer. Padasevanam, worshipping the lotus feet. That's six. Dasyam, service. Sakyam, friendship. And Atmanivedana. Atma means soul. Atma Nivedana. Full self-surrender. There's nine. But it all begins with the first two. Hearing and chanting. And hearing and chanting and hearing and chanting cleanses and takes away the covering, and then comes remembrance. Like, you know, a natural remembrance of, oh, that's who I am. And then from that remembrance comes prayer, some appreciation of who I'm connected with. And then worshipping of the deity. And as the goddess of fortune, Lakshmi, worshipping the lotus feet, rendering all kinds of services, becoming the friend of the Lord, surrendering everything to the Lord. Those are the nine processes. It begins with hearing and chanting. Okay? That where it's presented, since there's a little lull for a moment, you know who Prahlad? You've heard of his name? Prahlad? Prahlad is a small boy whose father is a meanie. He's worse than a meanie. He's like the meanest meanie. He's a terrible demoniac personality. And Prahlad is just this innocent little boy. And his father, Hiranyakashipu, hates God. He's like the terror of the universe. He's very powerful and everyone's afraid of him. But Prahlad's not afraid of him. So he entrusted his son in the school of demon teachers, teaching him how to be a nice demon. And he wasn't interested at all in that program. So one time his father had him sit on his lap and said, "My dear son, tell me the most wonderful thing that you have learned." And basically said, "I really didn't learn anything good in school, Dad, but here's something that I can tell you that's really good. Hearing and chanting, remembering the personality of Godhead and serving him," and his father exploded. "Where did you learn this?" But because that's something that's most wonderful. So he was so innocent. He wasn't intimidated by his meanie father. He was just saying what was true. It's the most wonderful thing that I've learned. Something else. You all have your nice Bhakti Vriksha gatherings and you talk with each other, and I'm not so intimidating. You can share something or ask something or whatever you want to do. Yes. Yes.
You know, obviously you have read a lot of books before you started understanding the Godhead through
ISKCON, right?
Was this knowledge was more logical to you?
Or yes.
Just because it was more logical?
Not just because. That it certainly was more logical. Uh-huh. You want to know, how did I get involved in, how did I get so committed to this? That's your question. No, human interest question.
Yeah, I wanted to know the truth, like the moment of truth. When you read this, and when did you get that realization that, you know, this is what...
It was gradual. It wasn't like woke up one morning and that was it. It was gradual. The commitment to the lifestyle that I'm living, that I've been living for 44 and a half years, of just nothing but this. That was a moment of truth involved in that one. And I'll share, if you want to hear that one, I'll share that one. I was in college, and there was a number of things that, that helped me get into a mode of searching. I'll share that a little bit. I was enrolled in medical school, and it was during the time of the Vietnamese War, and for some weird reason, the United States government decided I was a fit candidate to go leave medical school and go to Vietnam and fight in that stupid war. So my parents informed me while I was at school, finishing my graduate study, or undergraduate studies, waiting for graduate school, notices were coming at my home to say, 1A, a draft notice. You're supposed to go to the Army office and get your uniform and get on a plane and go over there to Vietnam. So I just ignored it because it was stupid. And time passed, and they said, the notices are still coming, and you know they're threatening, and you got to do something. So I said, okay, I better do something. And I tried to keep it short. I got some advice from some friends that there's Quakers, like Quakers that will give, they're giving advice how to fill out a conscientious objector form so you don't have to be part of the draft. I didn't know what that was, so I went to find out, and I got a form. And the first question on the form is, state the nature of your belief in God such that you cannot take part in the armed forces of the United States of America. So I started filling out the form because I know how to get A's in exams, and I can easily, you know, fill out the form and get out of the draft. But as I was started to write, the pen stopped. And I don't know what my convictions are. And that really flipped me. What? I'm on this, I'm doing all the things that a nice young man is supposed to do, like this and that, that and this and that and the other thing, and I don't even know what my convictions are. Whoa. That's not right. And once that light went on, then like 500 other lights went on. Like, what about all these other questions that I never asked because I was too busy being successful to ask them? Like, who am I? What's the purpose of life? Where am I going? And, well, wait a minute. So I did a timeout. Took a leave of absence from school and said, I want to get answers. And I'm not going to just like take anybody's word for it. This is the answer. I want my answers, my convictions. So that was like how the quest started. Then I started looking all over the place. First I went back to the tradition that I came from. And it was the same, you know, blank stare. They didn't know any more than I knew. So then I started looking around at other things. And I was like a kid in a candy store. It was like there's all these things that I never even knew they were out there. So I started doing all these different things. And some of them I rejected because they were silly. And some of them I was, in a disciplined way, was doing every day. Like I had this sadhana that went from this o'clock in the morning to that o'clock in the evening, and along with my academic work, I was doing different things. And Krishna arranged it that I was then living in a house with people that were like me, searching and doing different things. Some were doing this, and some were doing that, and some were doing the other things. And then some people would come in, they were doing some other things. Anyway, so it's like, it was fascinating. But of all the things that I was doing, I found that chanting of the Hare Krishna Maha Mantra was most effective, without all the details, but it was most effective in spiritualizing my consciousness and in a sustained way. So I started increasing my chanting. like, you know, just ruling out some other things, and some other things came to the top. That kind of procedure. And by that time, I had received Prabhupada's Bhagavad Gita as it is, after having read seven other translations of Bhagavad Gita, and realizing that I didn't understand it, and then getting a copy of Bhagavad Gita as it is, and finding it really easy to understand, and wondering why the other ones I couldn't understand, and why this is so easy to understand, and then it just came up just asking questions, and answers came. It's because it was from realization. It wasn't from academic speculation. Go learn Sanskrit and translate Bhagavad Gita and say, this means that. Because that's what they were doing. Instead of saying, this means this, it means this means that. Just interpreting. According to their scholarship and their whatever their inclinations were. I didn't like that. That was cheating. I was in a feisty mood. So I had some appreciation of Prabhupada's teachings. By that time, Prabhupada came to visit our campus. I didn't know who he was. I didn't know, didn't know a lot of things. But there was some interaction. I attended a function. Basically just chanted Hare Krishna. Spoke very little. Then invited people to the center that was just across the street from the campus. So one day, this group of us were living in a farmhouse some distance from the campus, renting it. And I just went for a long japa walk. And, this empty cornfield. On the other side of the cornfield was a tree line, kind of forested area, and just kept walking through the forested area. Then it just kept going, and then a little stream, and on the other side of the stream, and then the forest continued, just kept walking and walking. I was so absorbed in chanting, I lost track of, time and space. I just was absorbed in chanting. And then all of a sudden, the tree line ended, and off in the distance was the skyline of the city. And something happened. It went 10 things in a flash of a second. Here I was experiencing such a wonderful thing that had been given to me by the sacrifice of Srila Prabhupada to take me completely out of the world of illusion. And there off in the city was the skyline. He saved me from that to give me this. And I felt this overwhelming feeling of gratitude. And with that, I need to do something to reciprocate for the sacrifice that he made to give this gift to me. And I turned around and started walking back. And there was this feeling as I was walking back that I have to give my life to him. Put my life in his care. Let me be an instrument to him to do that which he's done for me, for others. But there was resistance. I didn't want to do that. I like my independence. Western people really value their independence big time. Big time. So there was this resistance kind of thing. But I knew that couldn't win. I had to reciprocate. And I didn't know exactly what that meant, but I knew I had to reciprocate. I can't just take and not reciprocate. That's not okay. And I've been given such a wonderful thing. So it was progressive to receive and receive and a little bit more, receive and receive and receive, and then it was this overwhelming, I can't just take, I have to. It's something like what parents hope will happen with their children one day, besides just, little needy machines that they have to, attention machines, you got to give attention and stuff and whatever they want. And at some point in time, the light goes on that says, wow, my parents are giving me so much. They care so much about like that kind of, and let me do something for them. Love. So that's what happened. And it, you know, even from there, it didn't like, okay, you know, my life has changed. It was still something progressive and gradual unfolding. But it's my life is still propelled by that experience. Anything else? Okay. I brought with me some, when I was in Vrindavan, I requested the devotee to give me some prasadam from the temple, Krishna Balaram Mandir temple in Vrindavan. And I refrigerated it. And I brought it with me. And I'm going to empty the box tonight. It's right here. Hare Krishna. Thank you all.